not unlike spring, April's cultivated audio is just bursting at the seams. Speaking first is world-renowned grazier and livestock breeder Johann Zietzmann. His expertise is pretty well summed up in his book, Man, Cattle, and Veld. Veld being open, uncultivated country or grassland in Africa. Betsy Ross, our second guest, consults with landowners to transition away from chemicals. The key to her success is knowing about and managing Mama Nature's, as she calls it, living system, using liquid compost, native plants, the soil food web, and understanding the subtle energy that runs through all. Joanne Myers is next, sharing about the rare breeds she and her husband Wayne have on their 250-year-old farmstead in Maine. And Ryan Walker is from the Livestock Conservancy, a brilliant resource for anything relating to rare and endangered livestock and poultry breeds. And I'm Robin. Let's dig in to the regenerative agriculture conversation. Johann, it seems your main influences early on were Jan Bosma, whose focus was on cattle, and John Acox and Alan Savory, who focused on the ecology and were committed to rehabilitating and improving the land. So I think you are the perfect one to chat with about regenerative agriculture. All bases are covered.
That is correct, yes. I was very interested right from the beginning of my teenage years, and that's how I got into contact with those three people you mentioned, and also Tom Lasseter from Colorado in America.
Would you say that you've learned many things from the tribal folks in Africa as well, or not so much?
I wouldn't say I've learned from the tribal folk, but I do acknowledge the cattle that they've been running and breeding are extremely good cattle.
There are always discrepancies between the study of a subject and the actual hands-on doing, and you were in the academic side of sustainable ranching and then found a whole different story being told when you came back to working on the land. How would you describe that?
That's very true, Robin. I did have an academic background under Professor Jan Bonsma. The problem is with people that are academics is that they don't see the challenges and the opportunities on the land. So what they recommend in terms of cattle breeding is sometimes at odds to what we require in terms of cattle to convert grass efficiently into a product that we can sell. So that's where the discrepancy comes. And once you start working on the land, you see the challenges, but you also see the opportunities.
You work under conditions that are very tough for the nutrition of cattle. Could you tell us about your environment in Zambia and your approach to breeding and feeding of cattle as a result?
Okay, let me just go back a little bit in history. I've been living in Zambia now for the past 2 years. Prior to that, I was born and raised in Zimbabwe, and that's where I grew up, and that's where my experience with cattle comes from. So in the northern part of Zimbabwe, which is very similar to the part of Zambia I live in, we have a very short, intense rainy season. We get about 40 inches of rain over a four-month period, very dry conditions where the grass dries out and becomes very fibrous. So the problem is, with high rainfall, grasses grow very quickly in the tropics, and then you have a very poor nutrient content of the grass, very high in fiber. And that is a challenge for most cattle.
And so how do you work with that?
What we'll have nutritionally adapted cattle in this part of the world that you require. With a smaller frame, because of that, they have a very high relative intake. Intake relative to size is much higher, larger frame cattle, which makes them nutritionally adapted. They have a higher intake, so they're able to put on body condition much quicker and have body fat reserves for the dry season.
I was reading some about your work and note you realize the importance of breeding cattle and cows as good grass converters. And does that cut down on the supplements like minerals that you might need? And how do you do that to help make them good grass converters?
It wouldn't cut down the minerals, particularly in protein. You would have to feed a protein supplement during a dry season to enable the microbes in the rumen to digest the grass. So that would be essential. But the fact that they have a higher relative intake allows them to put on body condition much quicker and have a greater body fat reserve for the dry season. But you will still have to give them a protein supplement. under those critical times. But they'll be more efficient in converting the glass than the larger frame cattle.
I see. Now, the protein supplement that you give them, what is that?
Yes, we rely on urea. The high urea supplements, it's much cheaper than the natural protein supplements.
And Johan, you are touted as being the first person to use ultra-high stock density. And could you describe what that's like and how you decided that was the best thing to do?
Well, I've been familiar with the work of Alan Savory since the 1960s. And I was aware of the fact that if we had to implement nations, we'd have to go to extremely high stock densities. Now, with conventional fencing, that was impossible. So it took me a long time to figure out how I was going to do that. And then on the 12th of January 1995, that is when I used portable electric fences with very high stock densities and with several moves a day. And that was a breakthrough, because then we could go to several moves a day, the equivalent of 1,000 or 2,000 paddocks per herd, as opposed to maybe 8 or 10 paddocks per herd with conventional fencing. So that was a breakthrough with the portable electric fences. And that happened on the 12th of January, 1995.
And then how did you notice differences with the cattle? And then I'm sure there was a lot of changes for the land, too, the way you were able to move the cattle around.
Absolutely. One of the problems we have in this part of the world because of poor nutrition is that under low stock densities, you have to allow the cattle to graze selectively. And by doing that, you're only utilizing maybe 50% of the grass. So by going to these very high densities, we were able to utilize 100%. So immediately, under my conditions, I could and I did double stocking rate. That was the first thing. And then over a period of 2 or 3 years, we changed the grass composition completely from a very poor, low palatable grass to grasses of higher palatability and higher productivity. By doing that, over a 7-year period, I was able to increase my overall stocking rate 4 times. In other words, after 7 years, I could carry 4 times the number of cattle on the same area of land.
That's pretty mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yes, and that's happening all over the world.
That's so great. I appreciate that you've been able to be a pioneer for all of that. But your dad was doing ranching before you, and is it true that they never would use any drugs on their cattle either, which was kind of unusual, wasn't it?
At that time in the 1950s, 1940s, 1950s, up to the early 60s, there were no supplements available in our part of the world. There were no scales available. So the ranchers at the time of the year, they just had to make use of what they had, which was basically adapted cattle and graze them selectively to a large degree. But those cattle from African origin were highly adapted, and also they were resistant to ticks and diseases. But under those circumstances, they also had to treat for ticks because some of the diseases that were introduced came from other parts of Africa, and the cattle here hadn't built up immunity to them. So it was a process that they went through. But then dipping became compulsory, which was the wrong approach. And eventually I realized that, and I came to a situation where I started only treating them strategically for tick-borne diseases and building up immunity as calves. So the calves were never treated for ticks, and that's how they built up immunity. But we still had to dip them strategically. But I believe that combination of that and selection, which I wasn't able to do because I lost my land and had to move, I would have been able to breed a herd of cattle that I would virtually be able to run without any chemical treatment.
What type of cattle are best over there, and how does it differ from cattle in other parts of the world, would you say?
Well, the cattle I'm referring to here are the African cattle, the African tribal cattle that were lived under very, very difficult conditions, not only natural selection in terms of climate and parasite diseases, but also the tribesmen corralled the cattle at night, and also they used them as draft animals. So those animals were selected under very severe conditions. So what happened is they had a very short period that they could graze, maybe 4 or 5 hours a day. So the cattle that developed under those conditions had a very, very high appetite, very high relative intake, which makes them nutritionally adapted to our conditions.
And what is the size of the cattle that you work with? And have all of your improvements made for much better meat?
The quality of the meat is not a problem at all. It's just a perception that people in the Western world want heavier carcasses if they follow the American model where they feed them in a feedlot. But our cattle, generally speaking, depending on our nutritional conditions as well, the cows probably weigh around about, I'm thinking kilograms, and I'm going to translate that quickly into pounds. The cows will probably be in the region of 700 to 800-pound cows, and the bulls will probably be about 12, 13, 14, 1,500-pound bulls. Yes, it's a reasonable size, but it's much smaller. They're not feedlot adapted because they can fatten on grass. So if they had to be put in a feedlot, they could still be fattened, but over a very short period of time. I see no problem. There's no contradiction for me between grass-adapted cattle and cattle that can still be put through a feedlot or under your own conditions on your own grazing felt with a supplement. They can be fattened, which is much, much more efficient than producing feedlot cattle where the females have to be fed to be able to produce sufficiently each year.
So do you do any feedlot cattle?
I personally don't, because personally I was involved in breeding bulls, but I wouldn't do feedlot cattle. If I had to, if my grazing conditions were such that nutrition was poor, I'd give them a supplement and fatten them on a supplement on the grass.
So, Johan, at one point you noticed that your land was definitely deteriorating. And was there one main sign going on? And what were the key steps in turning things around so you could feed your cattle?
Well, I was aware of what Alan Saver was saying and John Akers was saying for the many years prior to me changing. But the thing that made me change was a moment when I was walking through our felt, our natural pasture, and I saw two grasses standing next to each other, and they were both dead. One was died through overgrazing. In other words, it was kept short by grazing. And the same species, only a foot away, had died through lack of grazing. So the reason why that the stock density was far too low. So the cattle were selecting, and one grass was being overgrazed and diminished in its vigor by overgrazing, and the other one died because of a lack of grazing. So that's what really triggered my mind to go back to thinking about what Alan Saver and John Akers are saying. And that was a turning point. I realized then that I had to change my grazing system.
Hearing you say that, it sounds so simple, and it's a matter of one visual right there, and it changed everything, didn't it?
Yes, I was aware of what I was doing. It was wrong. But that one visual shocked me into deciding I had to change. And that's when I looked at how I could do it. But I realized at the same time that I had to go to very, very high stock densities. Otherwise, if I tried to graze all the grass at low stock densities, my cattle would suffer too much and I would never be able to utilize the land fully.
So did you increase your herd immediately? And
well, the stock density I increased immediately on the 12th of January, but my herd size I increased within a matter of weeks. The reason being I was in a fortunate situation that I had sold one farm and I was grazing my cattle on leased land, so they were available. But the problem is with most conventional ranches, when they change over to a very high stock density grazing situation where they utilize the grass better, is that they're short of cattle, they don't have enough cattle.
Right. How does that all lead into your calving season and being in line with nutrition for the cows?
Well, you see, one has to understand, Robin, that the most important factor determining profit is body condition. Body condition is everything. In terms of fertility, it's body condition and hormonal balance. But in terms of practical side, it's all about body condition. So cows have to calve in a very, very good body condition to be able to reconceive again quickly. And what's happening all over the world and here in Africa, the recommendation is to calve prior to the change in the season. In other words, to calve in dry grass and then you breed on green grass. But I came to realize very quickly that I had to calve on green grass, which no one was doing. So I changed that. And by doing that, I was able to shorten my calving season to a 42-day period, which is virtually unheard of all over the world. But it's the simplest thing to do if you understand that cows have to calve on green grass.
Yeah, I totally get that. And how do you see things progressing in Africa? Are other people catching on to this type of system?
It is to a certain degree growing in Africa. But I see a very big movement in the United States, Canada, and Latin America in particular. I've been involved in Mexico, and there's a lot of changes taking place in that part of the world where people realize that they have to change, and they are changing. And I've been involved with ranches there where they've tripled their stocking rate over a very short period of time.
I'm wondering what another financial tip is that you share with people.
Well, fertility is the foundation. Stocking rate is the most important factor determining profit. And second to that would be cow fertility. And to be able to have a high cow fertility, one needs to calve on green grass. The only disadvantage, if you can put it that way, is that calving on green grass, you'll have a lower weaning weight. But that's just because of a seasonal effect.
Johan, your creative expertise has led to many successes, so you've been sharing and consulting worldwide. Is there one topic or piece of advice that you include for anyone, regardless of where you are in the world?
There's four aspects, if I could summarize everything in a nutshell. Firstly, you need adapted cattle, okay? And that means climatically adapted and also nutritionally adapted. And secondly, you need to manage those cattle under very high stock densities to be able to use impact and non-selective grazing to improve the land and grow more grass and harvest it efficiently. Okay?
Yes.
The third one is that you need to plan your production system where cattle can calve on green grass and then wean them before they lose too much condition. So they go into the dry season and winter in better body condition.
Yes.
That's the third aspect. And the fourth aspect is that under most conditions where you have a long dry season or a dry winter, you need to have some form of protein supplement where you can keep the micro population up so they can digest the grass efficiently. So those are four basic things that will determine the profitability of your ranching situation.
Yes, and you mentioned earlier that a protein supplement that you use is the urea. Is that internationally used?
No, it's not. I'm amazed to see how few people in America know about urea or have used it. But some people that I've been in contact with are using it very effectively. But we use it effectively in Australia and in Africa.
All right.
But it's not common. It's not common in the rest of the world.
Right. And why did you move from Zimbabwe to Zambia?
Well, the political situation in Zimbabwe just made it untenable for me to keep on living there because I had my land and confiscated from me without compensation. I lost all my cattle. So my whole business just collapsed overnight. And we had no home, so we had to move around. And that's where I started consulting throughout the world to make a living. And now I've got the opportunity to start in Zambia, and that's why we've moved here.
Oh, I wish you all success there. I'm so sorry for the political situations that get in the way of too many things.
That is true. No, but we're very blessed at the moment. We have the opportunity to start over again. So
lovely.
I feel very happy about it.
Johan, I have never been to Africa, and I just have probably only a very romanticized version going on in my head, and I'm wondering, what is it like? Are there wild predators that pose daily concerns for having cattle?
There are parts of Africa, in Kenya, for instance, and maybe in parts of Namibia, we still have a lot of wildlife, where people basically herd the cattle, and then they corral them at night and for protection against the lion and hyena. But generally speaking, in other parts of Africa, there's not much wildlife mingling with the cattle. We don't really have that problem now.
Boy, I wish you all the best, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you for your trouble to get in contact with me and for the opportunity for me to share with other ranchers throughout the world what can happen if you work with nature.
Betsy, through your knowledge and work with Betsy Ross Grass-Fed Beef and the Sustainable Growth Texas, you've helped many transition from chemical to non-chemical systems of farming and ranching. What was your experience that got you on this train?
Well, I had retired, and actually I had never done chemical farming. I retired and left Austin and came out about 60 miles east of Austin, Texas. Here was this grand farm that the family had, and then one thing led to another, and I got more and more interested. And then I had this grandson born who was very premature. And that was back in the early 90s. And I just happened to be trying to graze cattle and do something with this land that had been heavily plowed and farmed into row crops, annual crop. And I'd grown up in a perennial grass system. And so that's what I knew about. But I went to a conference in Dallas and heard Sally Fallon talk. And she's with the Weston Price Foundation. And she gave this talk that day that we didn't want to be feeding grain to our cattle that inhibited them synthesizing essential amino acids, that we needed to quit that and our food supply would be healthier. With this sick child, I got so inspired that I came home and started thinking about that and thought, well, you know, I can do that for that child. I won't feed any of the cattle any more grain, and we'll see how that goes. Of course, that is a big leap. Of course, everyone said, oh, you can't really do that in Texas, and your cattle will do poorly. But there was something about that child I wanted to help, and so I got into some of the biology and Elaine Ingham's work and visited with the NRCS. And at that time, they said, I bet you will like this book, The Soil Biology Primer. And I was just fascinated by it. And that's what Sally Fallon was talking about, was not doing it with chemicals. I quickly found out when I moved over here to the farm that we got a lot of rain and things just grew. We were feeding everything, a little cracked corn, all the things Sally Fallon said to quit. So I decided to do this and started driving around Texas seeing what was happening. And people were doing manure tea and almost nobody was doing compost tea on large acreage. I decided Elaine Ingham seemed to have some science behind her. So I enrolled in some of her classes. It was a rich environment and it just blew my mind away. I came back and bought a compost tea brewer, called my brother who was my partner down here, and said, instead of putting out $6,000 worth of fertilizer, I've just bought a compost tea brewer. And he said, what is that? And I said, well, I'm not really sure, but I'm going to find out. But it's something about my growth.
That sounds like a great Texas spirit to me.
Well, one of the last things in that conversation he told me was, if you're going to do this, don't do it all over the farm. We'll go broke. And whatever you do, don't go organic. And I said, well, what is organic, really? This was a whole new vocabulary in the early 90s. And the NRCS guys came by and said, well, my goodness, what are you doing? Look at these nodules on your chicory and on your legumes. And I said, well, show me, you know. And so they did, and we quit feeding a group corn and started just grazing them. And we weighed them once a week on the computer scales. And, of course, we weren't putting on any weight doing it with cracked corn. My platform is, well, I'm going to see this through, because we're not doing any good with the chemicals anyway, and it's costing us a fortune to put all of those fertilizer out. We had lots of weeds, and everybody wanted us to kill the weeds. And when I was growing up, well, cattle ate the weeds, and it was the same group of weeds down here, and everyone was acting like, oh, your cow can't have that, or your steer, or whatever. It's not good. But I was noticing we didn't have any birds. I was used to birds, and the cattle still weren't gaining. So when I made this move, I thought, well, I can't do any worse. So we started doing the compost tea, making it here, and all of a sudden, our steers were gaining. So I called my brother one day, and I said, the cattle. He said, what, did they lose weight on your new method? I said, no, they gained weight. And there was silence. He said, well, did you back them off of the computer scales and clean out from under it and recalibrate it? Yes, did all of that. Huh. Well, what shall I do, Joe David? This seems to be working. Where do we go from here? And he said, I guess you just keep doing it, Betsy, and let's see where it goes. Well, word got out. People called me from all over, and they'd say, why would you possibly want to do something like this? You can do so much better, gain weight faster if you do the chemicals and you can sell them younger. I said, I guess, because I believe what Sally Fallon told me. And I've got this grandson that I want to be a part of his healing. And if this will help, by golly, I'm going there. Then I'd have other people call and say, oh, we're so glad you're doing something like this.
Yes.
Will you come to our place? And other people would drive up and say, well, we want to see these grass-fed beef of yours. Everyone knows you can't do that in Texas. And I said, okay, we can look. And they'd say, oh, my goodness, someone go get the camera. And I'd say, wait a minute, what are you looking at? I didn't know anything about fat pones on their rump or the feathers along their ribs or anything about Gerald Fry's stuff at that point, all of these signs for tenderness and this and that. So that was the beginning.
I became a member of a raw milk co-op when my first granddaughter was born myself. So we're on a similar trajectory here, Betsy.
It's about nutrition, but it's also about energy. And it's also about managing the soil as a community of microbes, a community of people. I always tell people I want to feed everybody, every living creature. There's room for them here. Whether they fly over or crawl over or run over or dig over or walk over, come on. And you little weed, you're going to help me. Why are you there? And I got into HMI, Holistic Management Institute, and it was a wonderful thing of ask why something is there instead of just trying to kill it because it was a symptom of something you didn't understand.
Yes.
So here I am still studying, but have a much better understanding of natural processes.
Yes.
Whether you call it sustainable or regenerative or organic, what it isn't, it's not toxic chemicals. So I'm so excited to be a part at my age of 83 now. I have a sustainable growth our company, and we've never advertised that company. We always say we're looking for people who are looking for us. And we go and actually help them set all of these natural processes up because it's all about Mama Nature taking care of everything. And if we would get out of her way instead of trying to think we're smarter or more clever or can get there faster, she has the answers.
Yes.
And so we've learned about photosynthesis. We learned about the microbes first, and that's supposed to be the silver bullet. That's all you have to do. Well, you get to plateaus and you want to understand more. You want better production. Why are they booming, busting the microbes you put down there? Why are they running out of food? It's no fun to run out of food. It's all related. Everything that happens in the soil is going to happen to whoever eats anything coming out of that. Whoever eats anything coming out of what's eating that is going to have the same problems. For instance, magnesium, we're so deficient worldwide, so is the soil. It just kind of gets worse and worse as it goes up the food chain.
Yes. Now, Betsy, I would like to take advantage of your expertise and pioneering work using liquid compost.
We had so many people that were just showing up, said, can you come help me? Can you come do my place? That we were just wearing ourselves out, making batches of compost tea. You know, you put the water in, you put the compost in, and you brew it for a while and you wake up all the organisms. When you wake up all of the microbes in the compost, you got to go put it somewhere pretty quick. And if it's raining or someone cancels or whatever, then you're going to have to put it on your place or have a place to put it because it can go bad very easily. By definition, good compost is 80 to 85% inactive organisms, but about 15-20% is inactive. So when we brew tea, we're waking everybody up with our food. So now you've got everybody that can possibly breathe and eat is doing that, and it saps all the oxygen out of that tea, and that's why it goes bad on you and why you have to put it out there. Well, we were handling so many people all of a sudden, trying to help them and do our land. We started looking at liquid compost extract. We had a friend that had developed an extract machine prototype of where they were stripping off the active organisms and the inactive too, and that would keep for a while. And we could keep it up to 2 weeks if we aerated it, but we didn't put food out to do that and wake everybody up.
I'm sorry, what are you speaking about when you say you didn't put food out?
When you're brewing tea, you're usually putting some molasses in to feed the microbes when they come out of dormancy, because remember, they're 85% inactive. So you got to put some food there. We put out kelp. We were doing humic acid, the kind of the traditional things you put out with tea, making it either bacterial or fungal, whichever one matched the plants we were trying to grow. You have to put that out on the land quickly, or it starts going bad. It becomes anaerobic. It runs out of oxygen, and they all die, and then you have to come back with more tea that is sooner, that kind of thing. So if you're looking at extraction, you're not waking everybody up. You're just stripping the microbes off of the compost in that 85% dormant, and then the 15 or 20% that are active. And then you're waiting on the plant to wake up which organisms they need to grow. So it lasts a long time, and you can hold it in a container a long time if you stir it occasionally. It's a little different technology trying to get to the same place, but it's more of a commercial model or a big landowner model.
Yes. When you say a long time, what is a long time?
Well, 2 weeks, okay. If we keep it stirring, sometimes 3 weeks.
Okay.
But we still like to go to the field soon with our trucks, and we call that liquid compost extract, or LCE. And then, of course, we started hitting plateaus where we could do real good, and then we couldn't, and it would be the same land, different pastures, same growth, same sort of grass. So we begin to think, well, obviously we need to look at the minerals, test the soil, see what's missing. Like if there's not enough magnesium out in the soil and you put a plant out there, then that plant is not ever going to photosynthesize well because you don't have enough magnesium to make the chlorophyll that's going to pull 80% of the nutrients, the carbon and everything you need, out of the atmosphere to be captured by the plant, make the sugars, squirt out the roots, feed the biology of all kinds, the biology refeeding the plant, having the energy to push it back up to the leaf and expire CO2, capture it again from the atmosphere, and every time you do that, everything gets better. But see, that all of a sudden isn't just adding to biology. That's working with a bunch of these natural processes. And our soils are so compacted because they don't have magnesium or they have too much calcium. In Texas, for instance, most of our lands hold on to too much of calcium, and the magnesium and the potassium don't have a place to hang on to, so that when the plant says, okay, I'm going to trade some of this with the microbes, all they can trade is calcium. So you create an environment where you create hidden hunger. All of this stuff was talked about in the 1920s, and Charles Walters used to say, we grow on the shoulders of those that came before us. And thank goodness they wrote about it. It's just a wonderful, marvelous journey. Imagine walking outside and you can feel the difference in the environment you're creating, whether it's your yard or your park or your pasture. And we call those sweet spots where everything, all the processes are harmonizing. And you have all the insects, and you have all a variety of plants. Well, we have come to realize that weeds are our friends. Weeds tell us so much. And why on earth we go about killing our weeds when they are pulling up the rare trace minerals that we cannot buy enough of and they're blended in. If we let them survive and add and help, I mean, we want everybody to help us move this land and this environment together so we can feel better ourselves. My pastures look wild, and people say, you need to get rid of these weeds. And I said, why? And they say, well, they're competing for the grass. I said, no, they're not. They're helping. So you have these tacky old weeds that are bringing up molybdenum and cobalt, zinc and iron, or they're redistributing it from deep down. Sometimes it's toxic because it's so much that the animals want to eat it. But it's still, when that plant senesces, it gives it back. And the next growing season, now we have some cobalt and some molybdenum. We can pull more oxygen out. We can photosynthesize better. We can make amino acids to turn into complete proteins all along the way that we can't do if we don't have those things.
Betsy, you were talking about having a more bacterial or fungal compost tea. What plants require one or the other, or how do you differentiate or decide?
What we're looking for is a fungal to bacteria ratio. If you have a lot of weeds, if you're just starting your regenerative process, you're usually going to be very bacterial. Most of the weeds are feeding bacterial. When they senesce, die down, what they give back to the soil is food to support the biology. They are smaller, the bacteria are, can survive longer. And then as you get more fungi into the soil, you're going to have more of your rangeland perennials. You're going to get on up to your prairies and to your forest finally. By feeding food stock to your compost pile, you can work with that ratio, and you want to match that ratio with what you're trying to grow. If you're doing gardens and row cropping, you're very bacterial. And we were very fungal when we first came to America. Then we started plowing. And then as we plowed more, we got rid of all the fungi, which is really the disease suppressor. When you're studying the biology like we're doing now, the fungal to bacteria ratio is really kind of your thumbnail of what you're trying to do.
So I was going to ask you then, suppose someone went online and they saw a compost tea recipe. I'm assuming that that might be better than not using any compost tea, but when you work with people, you consult all over the place, and do you get a soil test first, or is it more of a visual thing for you? How does it work for you?
Well, I'd like to go on the site and walk their land and dig their land and see what's there. What weeds are there, because they tell us a lot about what's going on. If I am starting with an old, worn-out cropland, I'm going to be digging in the soil and looking at the compaction. From that visit, I'm also going to pull a test, and I use Logan Labs because they give me so much information about what's soluble, what's not soluble, what the EC, what the nitrogen, what the ammonium, what the nitrate is, what the traces are. From that, I can correlate that with where the person wants to go. You know that if they want to have prairie and they've been plowing and using herbicides for 50 years on their land, that's going to take a lot longer to get to that prairie. The success of working these natural processes is understanding where you're starting from and what it takes to get to the next ecosystem that you're wanting to grow things in. And it's one of the things that I drill in people all of the time when I'm teaching. Most of the research is about row crops, which is about bacterial systems and annual systems. And if we set up the perennial system, we have to be more fungal. My understanding of it is that if we can get photosynthesis to work and all of this harmony and the symphony going among these processes, that the plant will capture the energy or the nutrients, the carbon, the oxygen, and the plant will take it down to the roots and feed the microbes at the root level. it's hard to do with an annual seed to get it down to the bottom like that, to the lower level. And that's where you really make your long-lasting carbon. And if you don't have enough carbon, your biology is going to run out of food. And then once it runs out of food, it's just like a human or an animal. It's going to die or senesce or sporate or whatever. And then you have to pump it back up again. Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could skip that part of it? And we can if we are building the carbon at that level. And you do that with the plant's photosynthesis and putting the microbes back down there in the food for them. Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely. Kind of leads to my next question, because I wanted to ask you, in jumpstarting not only our health, but what we're talking about today with the land, of course, it's always a journey of plateaus. And you mentioned earlier, well, it's working, and then all of a sudden it isn't. And is there a typical pitfall that someone, if they come across, they shouldn't get discouraged, but they can move beyond it? And of course, there's always a way. It takes creativity and knowledge, but there's always a way to move on.
Well, there's a lot more literature out there of people who are doing this worldwide. They're doing more of it around the world than they are here in America still. Harvard University grounds are all maintained with compost tea, and they have gardens up there. I think Alice Waters helped them grow their garden and develop that. But they have put everything out for public knowledge, and they tell you how to build a tea brewer, an expensive one. They also give you a very simple, basic recipe for making fungal tea and making bacterial tea. So those recipes are out there, and I usually give those to people. You know, if you do nothing else, you can do this. You can also buy some inoculums now that will do the tea. And there are just a lot more resources to help you now than there used to be. But to gear up for pasture land and large acreage of pasture land, you can't be going and spraying or adding minerals every week. It's just prohibitive. And so we usually try to go back 3 times in a 12-month period and get there with a carefully planned program of minerals and microbes and food for them and trying to build that carbon.
Is that all in the liquid compost that you spray, the minerals and the compost and the microbes?
Well, we will put out a dry mineral mix that we know will support the biology.
Great.
And build the carbon. And you've got to have up to 3 to 4% soil organic matter, because that's your measure of carbon, really, to be a reserve so these microbes don't go hungry.
Right.
So how do you do that when a fungi might need 80 parts of carbon to 1 nitrogen, whereas the bacteria need 6 carbons to 1 nitrogen? Your body needs 30 carbons to 1 nitrogen in every cell in your body. So how do you make that easy for that to happen? If you put out the big eaters, the bacteria will always eat first, but the big eaters, the nematodes and the fungi, will always eat so much more, they'll use up the carbon and leave the bacteria struggling if you just have 1% or less of carbon soil organic matter. So we take care of that by putting out a lot of humates, which are 65% carbon, and then the biology gets stabilized. The most important thing we've learned about the biology is it has to be fed, and it doesn't need to be running out of food just because there's a drought or that because there's too much water or because you're grazing wrong. You're not going to get there if they don't have access to vigorous amounts or volumes of food. And so we don't put out compost until we get that carbon and the minerals out, the nutrients that the biology is going to need to Perfect. Do this. So we'll come in first with a dry mix to do a lot of that, wait a little while, go back with our liquid compost extract, and we will also put food in to stimulate the indigenous microbes and those that have wakened up in the soil that are there from our putting our dry food out. So we're setting the table to kick off and jump start all of these processes, and then we're going to manage that with our management practices and not doing herbicides and insecticides and trying to kill everything we don't understand.
Wonderful. Betsy, I've got one more question for you, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
The way you've been speaking about the land and everything growing together, you're using words like harmony and symphony and tuning. And I know you're into the energy of things and the paramagnetism. And is there an example you could use to show why you use it and how you've seen results?
When we first started this, Malcolm Beck showed up and he said, "Well, this is really interesting. Have you gotten to paramagnetics?" I said, "What's that? I can't keep learning all this stuff, you know."
But then you said, "I could do that."
Yes. He also came up and said, "You need to start buying a truckload of molasses at a time, Betsy, with what you're doing." And I said, "Truckload of molasses? My gosh, that's 6,000 gallons. And he said, "Yeah, and here's what you need to do, and here's how that market works. And if you don't have the money, I'll loan it to you, but you need to get after it." I said, "Okay, give me the directions." But paramagnetism is a life force, and it is in the rare earth minerals. It just is one reason the Northeast and the wet, cold climates do so well, whereas down here we have weatherized our granite, and our testing shows almost no land in Texas unless you've added some of the paramagnetic earth minerals. You're just not going to have any. It's just negligible. Makes such a difference. And so why not get that back? It costs pennies altogether. We take it seriously when we go to someone's place that we're trying to help them jumpstart this stuff, do the best we can do. And the energy from nature and working together that creates that energy. The landscape architects, some of them can design things so that energy is not blocked. And it swoops along. We're doing it on animal trails. We do it on parks so that vandalizing incidents go down. Your cattle are calmer if you're using it out here. You want to linger, but you can't just pick out one piece of this and say, "That's all I'm going to do." At least I haven't found any land that you could do that to. We've been on a journey 25 years. I will always say, I don't think you need to take that long anymore. And certainly if you're a good grazer and you've been managing your land well, you're going to be ahead of the curve and can get there faster. But most of the land is so degraded, you're going to have to do a lot of all of this. And like I say, there's not just one way to do these things.
And the birds are probably back, right?
Oh, yes, they are. It's amazing. We have birders here, and we have the herbologists come out, and they don't have places like this where they can get wild oats. You know, we're taught wild oats are not good. They're not vigorous, but they're one of the oldest healing herbs there is. So we like people to come that are into that part of the things and into life everywhere.
Joanne, how did giving a home to endangered breeds become important to you and your husband, Wayne?
Both our parents farmed. Wayne's parents in the 30s and 40s, and it was a small diversified farm, and my parents in the 60s into the mid-80s, and again, a small diversified farm. And another angle was that my husband Wayne's always been interested in oriental rugs, therefore natural dyes and fiber. He would buy damaged rugs and fix them and then trade them up. So that got us kind of oriented toward fiber. And then both of us think that conserving and preserving old stuff is really good. And sometime in the 80s, Smithsonian Magazine had an article about endangered breeds, and all of a sudden, you know, all those different paths came together. we had enough of our parents' wisdom to know that the kind of farming that we were aiming toward, the fact that we weren't going to begin as 20-year-olds, basically try to get a farm without a mortgage and have enough to do whatever we need to do to create the infrastructure and to buy our livestock. And because we're small, a number of years ago, we were raising endangered breeds, and we thought, you know, if we're going to do something that's useful, we ought to aim toward those breeds that are endangered breeds that are really small in number, the most critically endangered. And with that, if we really try to practice good breeding, and we're adding just a few every year, and we do as much public education and information to visitors as we can, then maybe we're actually helping. And as you are also introducing your audience to the Livestock Conservancy, they are invaluable to us breeders.
Beautiful. And I think we all could learn a lot by having you share why your motto became yesterday's breeds for tomorrow's needs.
Well, even before what may be a sea change in local resources in rural communities as a result of this pandemic, we were aware of the groundswell of interest by people who wanted to have a farm but wanted to do small farm, by consumers who were really kind of shifting not just to organic but also to local and wanting to have a better connection with their farms. So, you know, when you get sort of oriented and educated about these endangered livestock breeds, you realize that their development occurred at a time when the breeds needed to be multipurpose and they needed to be appropriate for specific ecosystems. And we realize that those were yesterday's breeds, but it looks to us that they are going to be filling tomorrow's needs. And since then, of course, the emphasis particularly on crop farming, vegetable farming, and berries and so forth, that's where most of the movement is occurring. But we are seeing that people who want to have a small diversified farm and are interested in livestock see some real options and choices that these diversified breeds provide them that they don't get from monoculture breeds, breeds that were refined to be industrial breeds and serve a single purpose. For example, dairy cows.
Yes, a good example, right? Tell us about the breeds that you chose. You have a breed of goat and sheep that you have on your farm in Maine.
Yeah, of the sheep, we have three breeds. And one are Leicester Longwool, and another is California variegated Rommeldale. That's kind of like two strains within one breed. And the third sheep breed are Soays. Our Soays are registered by the Rare Breed Survival Trust in Great Britain. And they are quite endangered. And they're unique from the other two breeds that we have because they really represent a very ancient genetic package. So they've got some old stuff in their genetic package that is unique to all sheep, especially sheep in Europe. They're short-tailed. They're quite tiny. The goat breed that we raise is a special project where we are upgrading or upbreeding, which doesn't really relate to what you're doing. Basically, we are trying to establish a genetic reservoir of the Icelandic Cashmere dairy goat here in the state. And it's quite a long haul. The federal government and most all countries in Western Europe for sure and in Eastern Europe prohibit the importation of live sheep or goats. We prohibit, unless they're going to be eaten right away. We prohibit, Iceland prohibits, Canada prohibits both import and so therefore export. And the reason for doing that, which I think most everyone will understand, it's kind of basically a quarantine issue. We most all have the same diseases, all of us countries. But the only way that each of us countries can really control diseases in our country is by basically quarantining the country. So we couldn't bring in live female Icelandic goats or male Icelandic goats, but we could bring in male semen. And as long as it's frozen, keeps for a good many years. So we took that Icelandic goat semen, and we had to breed it to female goats that were available here in the States. And so we talked to the veterinarian geneticist who works for the Livestock Conservancy. He gave us some advice, and we started with Oberhofli, which at that time were an endangered breed, primarily a dairy goat. And so then we start to breed Icelandic semen, and I'll not go further on this story, but 100% male Icelandic semen to a female Oberhofli. The first generation is 50%. We take females from that generation, take 100% Icelandic male semen, breed it to a 50% Oberhofli, you get up to 75%. And it takes about 7 generations before you get up to 99%. So we were doing pretty good, and then the USDA said, oh, we need to change our testing, and you can't import any semen. And it was a couple of years, and we're hoping to import some this year. So we got set back a fair bit.
Oh.
But hopefully we're going to plunge ahead some years, have more of these goats, and be able to get them distributed elsewhere in the U.S.
Would they live well in any part of the U.S., do you think? Or
That's a really good question, and that also relates to endangered breed conservation, breeding, and regenerative agriculture. Iceland is a climate that would work for most of the northern U.S., the mid part of the U.S., not sure about really hot climates. The Icelandic Cashmere Dairy Goat was really a goat that was imported by the Vikings. They brought them over 1,100 years ago, and they also represent an ancient genetic package because hundreds of years ago, Iceland decided that its original livestock is a cultural heritage, and it prohibited the importation of other breeds of sheep or goats or of dairy cattle. So this Icelandic goat has also got a really bunch of old genes, which is just wonderful. Regenerative agriculture, I mentioned, is mostly to do with, you know, vegetable fruit farming, but it also engages livestock farmers, and in terms particularly of grass-fed beef. But the lay-in with these endangered breeds really fit the regenerative agriculture is that the breeds have specific ecosystem value. So there's a wonderful breed of cattle in the southeastern United States called the Piney Woods cattle, and it is great for a hot climate, and it is great for eating piney woods. Now, if I took that cattle and brought them up here to Maine, I would have to add inputs. I might have to build more shelter. They may not be able to graze for as many months of the year. I'd have to provide more hay. And while you can produce hay without using a lot of fossil fuel, most farmers produce their hay by powered tractors. Another reverse example is the Randall cow. It came out of Vermont, and it is very good in a cold climate. And it was rescued by a woman who was in Virginia at the time because she said they just don't do well in a hot climate. So if those cattle are best for northern climates, the better fit there is between an endangered multi-purpose breed and its original ecosystem, its original environment, the less you have to do to sort of jigger your operation to make it fit the breed. So the breed can live, in a sense, more naturally with fewer external input. It's a really good way of considering these endangered livestock breeds and where they're best suited for.
Yes, it comes down to economy and common sense, ultimately, doesn't it?
Yeah, you can go a step further and say not only should we be looking at the environmental ecosystem, but the community ecosystem, the society needs in our immediate consumer environment. What are the needs and issues that consumers have in this part of Maine where I might be able to produce for them? And what of these multi-purpose breeds fit that community and societal ecosystem?
Right. Now, tell us some specifics about your dairy goat. For instance, do you drink their milk?
That's a good question, and this applies to any breed of dairy goat. There seems to be some unique attributes of the Icelandic goat in terms of its dairy production. For example, the person in Iceland who has the largest herd of Icelandic dairy goats and was the leader in conserving these goats, she's been able to make butter. You asked if we drink goat milk, and what we do when our goat's kid or our sheep lamb, we leave the lambs and kids on the goats and the instance of kids and on the sheep in the instance of lambs. They just always do better. And we're not trying to sell milk. We would give it away if we were milking the goats. That's what we do at this point. Our plan, however, is to just make additional milk that we don't need available putting up a dairy is quite an operation, but we can share the goat's milk and share the pleasure of it with other people. We want to make our own cheese. But I think our plan would still be to leave the kids on the goats as long as they need to be, and then start to milk the goats when the kids don't need quite so much milk.
Yes, yes. Now tell us about the sheep's wool. How is that different? Is the wool perhaps warmer or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. We've only raised these endangered breeds, so I'd have to say that I've really not done much by way of comparison. In a general sense, and some of your listeners may know more than I think that probably there's not a lot of difference in texture or in use, but a major difference would be in colors. So along about the late 1800s, when commercial dyes became available, before then, if you'd looked at flocks all over the place, Europe here, Asia, wherever, you'd see a lot of different colors. You still see that with the Icelandic goats and the Icelandic sheep, just lots of different colors. But commercial dyers wanted white wool, and they wanted white wool because that took the commercial dyes better. And they had a much truer dye if you took an all-white sheep and used red dye on it than if you took part white and mixed white and so forth and used red dye to color the wool. So a big difference with these endangered breeds is that you usually find more colors. And some hand spinners and those who are going to almost directly from the sheep to doing something with the fiber, they like to have the different colors, especially if they're working with the natural wool colors.
Of course, yes. Beautiful. Wow, I certainly learned a lot. Thank you, Joanne.
Well, we are passionate about doing this. Any interest in endangered breeds is a help to endangered breeds. So even if your listeners just went to a farm and looked at the breeds, they know something then, and they can pass it on to their friends and neighbors and be alert to the issues around endangered breed conservation, which are really interesting. And the other comment is that it's such a wonderful group of people to work with. It is just fun, it's intellectually stimulating, and we learn so much all the time. And we learn from questions that people who have never heard about endangered breeds ask us.
Yes, and it's an inspiration for folks. All of a sudden, wow, I've got 10 acres. They could handle a couple of goat or sheep, right? You don't need a huge land mass to do that.
Precisely, yep. And you get good exercise. You are always in that way doing something in your community, even if it's just for people to drive by and see and admire the beautiful sheep out there. Mm-hmm. Hopefully the multicolored ones.
Right, yes. And I had to laugh at, I guess it was a little video I saw. Your husband, Wayne, he's serious about endangered species, too, because he drives a lot of antiquated farm vehicles, doesn't he?
Yeah.
That's the way to do it.
That's true. Yeah, he does a great job taking care of our equipment and working with the sheep. And he's doing a lot of felting with our wools from our sheep. So we raise some natural dye plants. And
oh, beautiful.
There's a lot you can do. And this year we're hoping to get some Dutch hookbill fertilized eggs out to folks. It's very, very wonderful.
Ryan, the Livestock Conservancy's mission is to protect endangered livestock and poultry breeds. Would you share why this is such a vital service?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Agriculture contains diversity on the spectrum of animals and plants. The Livestock Conservancy works on the animal side, keep trying to maintain biodiversity within agriculture. These are going to be our breeds that would have been raised for hundreds, and in some cases thousands of years, by farmers expertly bred to do very specific functions, produce meat, milk, eggs, grow wool, perform work. They've been developed over many, many years, but modern agriculture favors only a few very selectively bred breeds, and they tend to grow faster or produce more, but they may not necessarily fit into the model of agriculture that the regenerative ag field would prefer to use.
It seems as though in that commercialized breed, what happens is the health of not only the breed, of course, but the health of the individual animals tends to go down. Is that true?
It is. The best way I can kind of describe it is you can't have it all. Breeds contain many different traits. We've got growth rate. We've got the physiology of the animal, like the bone structure. We've got the color of the animal. We've got mothering instinct, ability to be resistant to diseases and parasites. What tends to happen when you focus on selectively breeding for one single trait, then you start to lose in all of the other areas. What tends to happen is we have some animals like Holstein cattle can produce exponentially more milk than they used to, but they've got many other problems. They've got structural problems. They've got mothering instincts that have been lost, lots of other issues. And that's just one example, but heritage breeds tend to fit into a more holistic style of agriculture because they're a little more well-rounded.
Yes, and it's so wonderful that we have the Livestock Conservancy as a hub for so many people. Are rare breed conservators mostly smallish farms working with rare or endangered breeds?
Yeah, for the most part, it's going to be your small to medium-sized farms. In order to raise heritage breeds in the types of situations and models that they're designed to live in, you know, back 200-300 years ago, we didn't have mega farms, at least not in the definition that we have today for modern industrial farms. So your heritage breeds were really designed to live in anything from a backyard to maybe what would borderline on being called a medium-sized farm today. But it takes more land, usually, to raise them because that's the type of model that they thrive in best. If you take heritage chickens and crowd them together, they're not going to do as well because they haven't been bred to live in that type of a situation. As opposed to letting them free range or giving them more space, they tend to excel in that type of setup.
Yes, like we all do.
Yeah.
Feels so much better, yes. What is your favorite resource that is available from the Livestock Conservancy to the people that are members or perhaps just out in the world?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think probably I'm going to split it into two, but my favorite resources are our Breeders Directory and our Heritage Breed Marketplace. So these are ways that farmers can get in touch with each other and they can find their heritage breeds. And also consumers can look for products. So whether you're interested in some steaks or cheese or milk or fiber, those can all be found through the directory in the marketplace. Our conservation priority list is on our website. That has the full list of nearly 200 breeds that we work with, 11 different species. We've got information about each breed with photos and descriptions of the breeds, and even some charts where you can compare breed to breed to decide which breed will work best for you. You know, because people live in different climates, they live on different size farms, they may have different preferences. And so that's the beauty of the diversity in these breeds is we get to pick what works for us and also some animals that we're going to enjoy looking at frequently because they're going to be around.
Perfect. Yes. And they all have different personalities too, I'm sure.
They do. They do. Yeah. Lots of different quirks and traits. It's really neat. Even within breeds, you can have different bloodlines that are known for different things. The diversity is quite beautiful.
Today's regenerative community included Johann Zietzmann, Betsy Ross, Joanne Myers, Ryan Walker, and Jocko, the Araucana cockerel from the Owl Farm in Wales, helping us to get things started. Find us with new shows and podcast links every month at cultivatedaudio.com. I'm Robin Clare. Here we are. Let's dig in and make here where we want to be.